Today's podcast is brought to you by Audible.com. Get a free audiobook download at www.audibletrial.com/thedrilldown. Over 100,000 titles to choose from for your iPod and MP3 player. Hello and welcome to The Drill Down, the podcast where we take a look at some of the week's most important events in tech and on the web and how they affect us all. I'm Andy Cercini.
I'm Dwayne DeFreitas.
And I'm Tosin Onofawakin.
This week, we're celebrating the Drill Down's 300th episode, and tonight we're going to do something a little different. We're going to cover a few important headlines, and then after a short break, the rest of the show will be devoted to our impressions on the technology that has personally moved us from our early experiences to our most recent connections. As always, you can check out past episodes of The Drill Down, as well as the other fine shows in the Geeks of Doom podcast network on geeksofdoom.com. Subscribe to us on iTunes by going to geeksofdoom.com, and our subscription link is in the right-hand sidebar. And join us on Facebook and Twitter at The Drill Down. Our show is also on Stitcher at stitcher.com, and you can search for The Drill Down there. As we said, this is going to be a little bit of a different show, but there were some headlines that I feel that are crucial to report about this week because they're fairly groundbreaking. And right off the bat, we have news that the National Security Agency, the NSA, has secretly broken into the main communications links that connect Yahoo and Google data centers around the world, according to documents obtained by former NSA contractor Edward Snowden and reported in the Washington Post. By tapping those links, the agency has positioned itself to collect at will from hundreds of millions of user accounts, many of them belonging to Americans. The NSA's tool to exploit the data links is a project called Muscular, operated jointly with the British counterpart, the GCHQ. The NSA and the GCHQ are copying entire data flows across fiber optic cables that carry information between Yahoo and Google data centers. And that's especially striking because the NSA already has front door access to Google and Yahoo user accounts through their PRISM project. In a statement, Google's chief legal officer, David Drummond, said that the company has, quote, long been concerned about the possibility of this kind of snooping and has not provided the government with access to its systems. He says, we're outraged at the lengths to which the government seems to have gone to intercept data from our private fiber networks, and it underscores the need for urgent reform. Yahoo spokeswoman said, we have strict controls in place to protect the security of our data centers, and we have not given access to our data centers to the U.S., to the NSA, or to any other government agency. In an NSA presentation slide as part of this leaked report on, quote, Google Cloud exploitation, a sketch shows where the public internet meets the internal Google Cloud, where the data reside, in hand-printed letters, and the drawing notes that the encryption is, quote, added and removed here. The artist, whoever drew this slide, also added a smiley face, which is a cheeky celebration of victory over Google security. Two engineers with close ties to Google exploded in profanity when they saw that drawing. I hope you publish this, one of them said. So, fairly damning report. NSA is not only, you know, using the Justice Department to get in Google and Yahoo's front door, but they're also sneaking around the back and getting the data right off the fiber between them.
It's like a weird kind of double
double whammy.
Double penetration, yeah. Kind of situation.
It's a double data penetration. Exactly. Yeah. It's and just as obscene, I think. I don't know. I'm stunned. I don't even know how to react to this. You know, every week it's something more heinous, and this is like the pinnacle. I don't know how it could get any worse than this.
Oh, it has a smiley face on that diagram. That's got to be positive, right?
Well, I mean, this is just more and more evidence that goes to show that what Edward Snowden is doing is highly disruptive.
Yeah.
Because it really, you know, I thought that, hey, you know, whatever. Okay, spying, that's the deal. But the levels go deeper and deeper and deeper.
like how much do you justify? It just
goes so much deeper,
right?
That I feel like I can't. I am no longer at a place where the normal apathy of a news cycle matters. I used to see this stuff, and I'm like, wow, really? I'm consistently outraged. That's kind of a big deal. that I'm able to be consistently outraged, and it's crazy. Like it's crazy. J. Edgar Hoover level upsetness.
It really is. That's a great analogy.
The overreaching and possible illegality of what's going on. The forget illegality. The not rightness.
Yeah.
Is like when you think about J. Edgar Hoover tapping Martin Luther King's phone lines. Right. It's like that level of not rightness.
Collecting files on American citizens for potential blackmail use. That was one of the other things that Hoover was accused of doing. But yeah, that is right on this level, and it's fairly damning. And once again, I have to ask, you know, when will the level of public outrage reach so that I think we're going to have some sort of international backlash. That to really sort of bring it home that our government is not playing nice, and we shouldn't support what the NSA is doing. And in fact, I mean, this brings us right up to the next story, which is about Deutsche Telekom, which is the German company. They want companies to cooperate to shield local internet traffic, the German local internet traffic from foreign intelligence services like the NSA. And this comes in the wake of evidence that Chancellor Angela Merkel's mobile phone had been monitored by the NSA. Essentially, what they want to do is to create their own German intranet. An internet that is strictly German. And the implication for this is fairly explosive because like if other countries decide that they want to do this and they have the right to in the light of the evidence, the mounting evidence that the US is unconditionally spying on their citizens, you know what we're gonna end up with having is a balkanization of the internet. We're gonna have, runs completely counter to the whole purpose of the internet in the first place.
Doesn't this sound like the new age of the Cold War, where the battle is not, you know, a physical battle between countries, but a digital one?
Absolutely. I hadn't even thought about it that way, but you're absolutely right.
The cyber battle has been something the Air Force has been talking about for a very long time. It's just that it's to me, it's even more far reaching than that. Like this is Skynet level. What we're seeing here is something that's basically saying we're going to convince governments to take themselves off the internet, put themselves on these intranets, which means that we're going to convince governments to sequester themselves from everybody else. If a bad government gets in power from this kind of behavior, from this kind of a new infrastructure, then there's a potential for every single nation to be quickly become an Iran.
Right.
There's also just the fact that
or China.
Yeah, an Iran or China, and there's also just the fact that as the other nations see this overreach, they're not just outraged; they're jealous, and they're gonna want to see what they can do to get in on their citizens. That's so they're all yelling, America, stop. But our allies are also going to be like, now that you stop doing it to us, teach us how to do it to our citizens. That's like what happens in these cases. You know, I feel like on some level we've signed the death warrant for our freedoms and liberties. Right now, Britain is, you know, when it comes to hacking and a lot of phone scandal stuff,
yeah,
they're putting new restrictions on their press. You better believe they're also going to put new restrictions on the internet because of this. So this is culturally damaging
yep.
work
yep. Yep.
that the NSA is doing.
This is like the what the NSA and the GCHQ, the British counterpart, are doing. The analogy would be like the bombs at Hiroshima and Nagasaki, which led to a Cold War buildup of nuclear armament across the around the world. I have a feeling that that's exactly like what we're going to start seeing now is a separation of an exchange of data between countries. And once again, like you mentioned, a tendency for the countries to start spying on their own citizens, because we did it. Great Britain did it. And they justified it in the name of international security, national security. So why can't all the countries do it? Anyway. Moving on. Netflix made a splash this year by creating its own TV shows and delivering them over the web. Now it's toying with the same idea for movies. This summer, Netflix announced that in addition to TV shows like Orange is the New Black, it would start spending money on modest movies, documentaries, and stand-up comedy specials. I think I saw a recent ad for an Aziz Ansari, a stand-up special that was a Netflix exclusive. Now, Netflix is floating the idea that it will foot the bill for a quote-unquote big movie, which would appear in theaters and on Netflix at the same time. In a speech hosted by Film Independent, the nonprofit behind the Indie Spirit Awards, Netflix content boss Ted Sarandos said Netflix could start delivering new movies to its subscribers by doing the same thing it's done with original TV shows and becoming a first-run distributor. What we're trying to do for TV, he said, the model should extend pretty nicely to movies, meaning why not premiere movies on Netflix at the same day they're opening in theaters? And not little movies. There's lots of ways, and a lot of people do that already. Why not big movies? So essentially what he's suggesting is producing, you know, Netflix financially backing a huge Hollywood movie and then doing a day and date release on Netflix and in as it is in the theaters.
And that's the only way they can really do it, because the idea that Netflix would create a Netflix special or whatever, it comes across as some sort of straight to DVD distribution, which Netflix is known for having.
Yeah.
So if they want to make a splash, they're going to have to make a movie that's on the same epic quality that Hollywood's trying to put out. And frankly, the same writing and acting quality that we see from things like House of Cards. We're going to have to see that level, that Emmy Award level of winning. And then we're going to have to see what happens when they're like, look, I'm going to use old media but not forget new media. How many movies are going to be pirated if it's released on Netflix and in the theater at the same day? I'm asking. If you can get the movie on Netflix and it's released in the theater,
yeah,
will you pirate it?
Well, I bet a lot less people will.
Yeah, I'm saying. What would be the point, right?
That's incredibly important. It's important to be able to look at. I mean, you've been saying it for how long now?
Yeah.
Well, if people had an easier way, then they wouldn't do it. Now, yep. I don't know if people should do it anytime, but if you want to disrupt that issue, what you do is you begin price discriminating based on what the people that are with you can afford or willing to pay for, right? One of the big arguments about pirating is that, well, we're losing all these ticket sales, when in fact, I think many people understand that. No, there are plenty of people who would never have seen your movie, and it probably would not have gotten the cultural reach if it wasn't on a place where they could get it for not seeing it for, you know, $10 a pop. Because people are going to download and watch things that they wouldn't otherwise pay for.
Yeah.
Netflix is breaking that wide open and saying, everybody has Netflix, at least 20 million of you do. And, you know, it's not expensive. The movie's out. You're not going to see a version of the movie that's been filmed on a camera, you know, like an iPhone or something, or like a, because you can just get the full quality thing on Netflix. I mean, I think it's, I'm impressed.
Well, what I want to know is, like, there's a couple of questions that pop up in my mind when I hear this. Is, first of all, how would something like this impact the Hollywood, the studio system in general, if Netflix were to put the pressure on day and date releases, you know, how would that pressure affect the other studios? What would their reaction be?
I mean, I think you see Universal on one level, Universal, the other guys, they might very well come out and say, I'm going to create my own Netflix.
But it also potentially could allow them to budge a little bit more in terms of, you know, like right now, the way it is, there are so many delays and limitations in play before people can actually watch new like content that's just finished in theaters. Right. There's like it's got to be on Blu-ray, and then there's a month period behind that, et cetera, et cetera. So maybe if things are successful, Netflix commands a bit more power and can negotiate, can reduce
to
those
get rid of these artificial barriers.
Right. Right.
The artificial ones that say, okay, I've got a business. Well, it's going to screw their business deals a little bit, Tosin. So like right now, you know, I'm Redbox. I get your movie first. Netflix gets your movie after 30 days. That kind of thing happens. They would have to renegotiate those things. But if they had their own streaming media service and they said that they were going to release their movies, their own movies after 30 days or their own movies after the box office big opening weekend or whatever, they might drive appointment viewership and be able to get some money out of that. I just don't know how it works economically when it comes to the all important first weekend on the blockbusters in 9 weeks.
Well, and that leads into sort of the other question that I had, which is from a personal sort of experience point of view, what would this do to, because for me, going to a movie theater and sitting in a large hall with a group of people in the dark sharing that experience is, there's a certain magic to that experience. And if more people think, well, you know, there's, why would I spend that money and go into a theater when I can just watch it on free on Netflix? What's going to happen?
Well, let's be clear.
I'm sorry, not on free, right? But for my regular subscription.
People, I think for that cultural moment you're talking about,
yeah,
that's clearly going to change. But think about it this way. How many people can you get over to your house to watch that movie? Or how many times have you seen Facebook light up at the end of an episode of Game of Thrones?
Right? Oh, absolutely, yeah.
So if Netflix is going to drop a new flick and put, and they can afford to put the big mm-hmm. budget money behind it, and the, you know, like in terms of the promotion of the flick and what's going on, and that flick has all the same situations as a Hollywood film.
Yeah.
And then suddenly it's available for all these people to watch because they're paying the equivalent of a movie ticket to Netflix every month anyway.
Yeah.
Then I see that there's a thing here. There's something here. So
I hear maybe
why sit around with people you don't know?
Yeah.
When you can say, dude, that movie's coming out. You want to come over? Because Andy's got the big projection situation and all the room to watch it.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's the thing. Yeah. I do think on some level this is going to affect what types of movies they release. I don't see a huge sci-fi blockbuster being as popular for TV plus Netflix as it would be just for, I mean, for movie theaters plus Netflix as it would be just for big movie theater alone. You know?
Yeah, and I think the other thing to really keep in mind is how many people actually do make it to the movie theaters versus how many people could you now distribute some property, be it large, be it small? Like, you get to touch a lot more people. I mean, I know for us, like, movie buffs, having that communal experience is really nice, and the societal experience. And I think that still will be there for certain films and for certain conditions. But I think there's still a lot of value in being able to, you know, for a lot of people who can't go out all the time, who maybe have younger kids or other responsibilities.
Yeah, how many times have you heard somebody say, man, I didn't see a movie for 3 years after my kid was born,
yeah.
Right?
Crazy.
That's for
why?
Sure.
Because it's crazy expensive.
Yeah.
Well, it's crazy expensive. Think about it. So it's like, you've got to go get a babysitter. You've got to make sure that there's like food. Then you get in the car, you go, you want to do, you know, you want to make a night of it, whatever. You get in there, you watch this film, you get out, you rush home to get back, to relieve the babysitter, and then you're home again. That's a lot of overhead. It's expensive, yeah, yeah. Not just financially, yep. But just in terms of the planning, the thinking, all that stuff. It's not great.
It's cheaper to buy the Blu-ray, you know, out and out. The only difference
is to rent it, to wait. It's cheaper to wait.
Yeah.
It's cheaper to just wait. So it's an expensive endeavor. especially when you have a child or some other personal obligation that requires finances. You're like, am I going to go watch some story on in the movie theater and not spend that pivotal early time with my kid? Or am I going to do that and just see what's on TV? Stuff has come out. It's new to me. Netflix is bridging that. So I don't know. This to me is highly disruptive.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
And extremely awesome.
One of the last things I wanted to touch upon before we move off this subject is something that you sort of hinted at a little earlier, which is, I think that what you're saying about the experience is that we kind of have that shared experience through social media with shows like The Walking Dead and Breaking Bad, and even shows that are like Arrested Development or Orange is the New Black, where they're binge watching shows like that. And that what you're saying is that, what I hear you saying is that if Netflix gets into day and date movies, that the shared experience that we normally have in a theater in a big hall in the dark with 300 people is going to shift to online social media the way we do now with good TV shows that we all watch.
I mean, that is where I'm leaving. It's about the fact that you can connect. When American Graffiti came out, freedom was about your car.
Yeah.
Today, kids don't want cars. The car manufacturers themselves are saying, what do kids care about the most? Replicating the phone experience and the infotainment dashboard situation and low gas mileage. Why? Because it matters less to drive to a place like a movie theater. It matters to go, like, more to go just from A to B. And people don't need to be out like that. It's a cold. It's a winter night. Oh, here's Netflix. What if Netflix decided to do it like Amazon Prime does it? What if they said, hey, you pay $8.95 a month. We're releasing a brand new movie. You can watch it at home and unlock it for $2. I mean, if it had the big budget stuff around it and all that stuff, and you were able to pop onto your Apple TV or Roku or whatever and hit a button and unlock the new movie because it's the new release and it won't be, you know, it's only available for $2 extra, you would do that, right?
Oh, for sure, yeah.
And that's how they would begin to attack the financial dearth that happens if they're just using the subscription numbers in order to pull that off. But Netflix is sitting on money and they're trying to figure out ways to use it that aren't crazy. Right?
Yeah, yeah.
Netflix buys a social media company. Netflix invests in making their own Redbox things. You know, that's all weird stuff. But saying Netflix invests in more content, that makes sense.
But that's non-trivial. What we're talking about. Because what we're talking about is if we move from a shared experience in a movie theater to a shared experience for a feature film online, that's the first change. That's a cultural change of that type that hasn't occurred since the beginning of film. It's on that level of a cultural shift in the way we experience shared media. So, I mean,
it's the biggest thing since streaming, but I don't think it's the biggest thing since, like, talkies. It's just the biggest thing since streaming.
It could be the biggest thing since streaming, because it really is how we collectively.
It's definitely the biggest thing since streaming.
I'm sorry, it could be the biggest thing since talkies, because it's a change in how we collectively experience the medium. So this last topic you dropped in here, Dwayne, and it's there's a new subsea tunnel in Turkey that links Europe and Asia.
So, just from a pure technological and geek perspective, this exact right now, today, the 30th of October, Turkey, with technology and support from Japan and also, you know, funding from Japan, mm-hmm. just created the first intercontinental train tunnel. So you can get on a train in Europe and get out in Asia. Now, is Europe and Asia, are they really different continents? People can debate that forever. But this is the deepest tunnel that travels an incredible distance, and it bridges people culturally. The last invention like this, the last kind of foray into this technology, was the tunnel that goes under the English Channel,
mm-hmm.
which is awesome. It's awesome. But you can now get on a train in England and stay on the train system until you're in Asia. I mean, that is
sure.
moving things forward. And while we're like, well, there's the internet, or like you get in a plane or whatever, this opens the door for goods to be transported. This opens the door for people to be transported in a new way.
Mm-hmm,
and mm-hmm. It's just pretty exciting. And it was undoable before very recently. Ataturk wanted this. He couldn't pull it off. So it was definitely something interesting. And another thing is that the United States had nothing to do with it, which is typically not the case when it comes to such groundbreaking innovation.
Uh-huh.
So in a world of globalization, there's that.
It's fairly impressive. It's 1.4 kilometers. The total of the length of the tunnel is 8.5 miles. Underwater, it's 1.4 kilometers, but 8.5 miles total. And it is intercontinental as opposed to the Channel Tunnel, which is just within one continent, within the continent of Europe, even though it is across a body of water. This connects Turkey, which is Eastern Europe, and Asia. So mm-hmm. truly intercontinental tunnel. Well, that's interesting.
Yeah, it's just an example of like phenomenal engineering.
Yep.
In meat space in the real world.
All right, so let's take a moment here to talk about our sponsor, Audible.com, the world's leading provider of digital spoken word entertainment on the internet. For the listeners of the Drill Down podcast, Audible is offering a free audiobook download with a free 30-day trial to give you a chance to check out their service. And the book I'd like to talk about this week is Ender's Game by Orson Scott Card. And this particular version is a special 20th anniversary edition, which is actually a dramatization. It's the unabridged version, but they've dramatized it with a full cast. And anyone who doesn't know about or is unfamiliar with Ender's Game, it's truly one of the seminal science fiction novels of the 20th century. It's basically about a war between Earth and an alien race, which has been raging for 100 years, and the quest for the perfect general, which has been going on underway for just about as long. And within that scenario enters Andrew Ender Wiggin, the result of decades of genetic experimentation. Is Ender the general Earth so desperately needs? The only way to find out is to throw him into the ever harsher training at battle school to chip away and find the diamond inside or destroy him utterly. And the crucial fact about this scenario is that Ender Wiggin is 6 years old when his training begins. And so this is really a seminal novel because it discusses concepts of leadership, independence and self-reliance, abstract thinking, and really sort of is prescient into how we approach warfare today, remote warfare and warfare training the young in unconventional, non-linear thinking.
I think Ender has a bigger. It actually has. I mean, it has another pretty big reach, and this is a bit more mundane than the shooting of things and the the video game usage of stuff. Like, look at the warfare. Look at what Ender's doing, and the obvious conclusion I come to is drones. How we're using them today.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
But then if you look at him again, like look at it just a little deeper, and there's something that Ender does that doesn't involve shooting. It doesn't involve manipulating spaceships to destroy anything, like, the simulations that he does, all these things. The thing about it is that there's Ender's sister and
right.
there's Ender.
Right.
And together, they effectively get on Twitter and take over the world.
Yep.
Together, they effectively become the bloggers of the planet. They're the people who wrote Dreams of My Father, which took Barack Obama from relative obscurity right. into the White House.
It's the influence of social media.
Yeah, they used social media in an age where social media didn't even
right.
exist. It was as a glimmer in the normal public sphere. It was this is to me Orson of. Scott Card's
yep.
greatest achievement in Ender's Game. The ability to foresee social media in a way that stays relative.
Yep.
Incredibly relative today. So if you guys haven't read this, and if you haven't, it's about as strange as not having read a Star Wars or not having seen Star Wars. But
definitely worth checking out.
I
just got a few friends who recently picked it up, and they're going through it and really enjoying it. It's a very quick read, and say try and check it out before you see the movie.
It must be a mind blower,
or maybe just don't even see the movie because the book is. Yeah. maybe it doesn't have to be a movie for every book. Maybe we could just explore media and have that media exist on its own, and maybe the people who make movies can go ahead and make movies from scratch the way they used to be, instead of making sure that the top 10 films every single year either came from a book, a comic, or a sequel. I'm going to say maybe.
The hell you say?
Maybe it's not about redoing everything, and maybe it's about actually doing something new, Hollywood. Netflix, please save me. Please save it.
I'm 100% with you, but, you know, I think...
With the exception of Days of Future Past, then we don't need any more movies that are derived off of old material.
I think richer heads will prevail. And in any case, to download that free audiobook or any one of Audible's other 100,000 plus titles, go to audibletrial.com/thedrilldown. Again, that's audibletrial.com/thedrilldown. For that free audiobook and the 30-day trial to check out their service. Even if you hate the Audible service and cancel it, you still get to keep Ender's Game for free.
Andy, how many times have you endorsed Audible on this show?
300! Dozens and dozens of times. Yes, many, many times. But you know, it's completely worth it. It's really, to be honest, it's really how I consume books these days. I have a Kindle account, and I occasionally get a Kindle book, and that's a great way, too, to read it. But a lot of times I don't have time. Like, most of my time is spent on the road, like on...
in the car. In the car.
And Audible is really the only way to go in that respect.
In many ways, then, I think Audible is a really helpful way. We're talking about this 300th episode. We're talking about technology that's really meaningful to us. I mean, it wasn't on my original list, but I think that the audiobook, the digital audiobook, is definitely a piece of that.
I would agree. I would completely agree. In any case, so there you go. Audibletrial.com/thedrilldown. We're going to take a little break here, listen to some music, and when we return, the tech that made us who we are today. So take a listen to this, and come on back. If you're just joining us, you're listening to The Drill Down on Geeks of Doom, the roundtable podcast where we take a look at the best in tech and on the web and how it affects us. I'm here with Dwayne DeFreitas and Tosin Adafouakin. The Drill Down's been going on for a long time now. We first launched in July 28th, 2007, with original co-hosts Muhammad Salim and Reg Sadler and myself. And we're on the 300th episode of our show. as we record this week. And we've gone through a long sort of evolution on the show. We started the original sort of conception of the show was Reg, Muhammad, and myself chatting on Skype. And we said, well, because we would often chat about these tech subjects just within between each other. And the way, and back up just a little bit, we all met through the social website dig.com. We were all top submitters on Dig. And through chatting on Skype, we would talk about tech topics. And then we decided that, what the hell, why don't we just record it and just see if anyone else wants to hear it. So we started recording our conversations, and we would publish them as podcast episodes. And the original conception for the show in general was that we would take one particular topic, deep thought tech topic, and drill down into it until we sort of picked it apart from all different angles. And my sort of role on the show would be the sort of the everyman, the average Joe, who would have my more technologically adept co-hosts Reg and Muhammad at the time sort of explain things to me in a way that the average listener could understand, and that would be our take on the technological topic of the week that we would come up with. So on this particular episode, we are going to sort of do a little nostalgia run and talk about the technology that has influenced us, that has really affected our lives, going back to, you know, essentially the beginning of our connection with that particular technology.
So you're basically saying that the Drill Down is the Destiny's Child of podcasts, where you're Beyonce. Yeah.
If Destiny's Child had a new cycle of co-singers throughout the, because Beyonce is a solo act now, right? Imagine if Destiny's Child was still around and Beyonce had replaced the other two girls.
She did over and over and over again, and then finally she went it alone. Tosin and I see how this ends. I get it.
Well, I'll still be here. I don't know who else is going to be joining the journey with me, but hopefully it'll be you guys for a while. So
you're like the doctor.
I am.
We're companions for right now.
Yeah, you guys are my companions. I like that. I like that analogy. That's a better analogy for me than Destiny's Child. So let's talk about this. The technology that has personally moved us. And why don't we start, Tosin, with you, with one of the technological bits and pieces that has affected your life and made you the person that you are today, like the early tech.
Well, you know, one of the early pieces of tech that I actually still return to is, drumroll please, the Super Nintendo. So the SNES. I just have so many amazing memories from it in my youth. Now, when I was a child, I didn't have any video game consoles of my own, but my friends did. And these are people who I would carpool with in the morning. I lived a couple blocks away. And so every morning we'd go over, I'd make sure I had everything in place, and we'd get to play video games for a little bit. I remember just, you know, early mornings playing Zelda and Bomberman, as well as, you know, coming
Bomberman
over after school. Yeah, Bomberman was just so awesome. I played that so much. If there had to be like a video game that I'm the best at, like ever, uh-huh, it's probably the SNES version of Bomberman. Just undefeated at that sort of thing. And I even remember like just so many shared experiences with that console. And it's sort of kind of also been the thing where those memories still last and continue, and you can share it with another generation. Playing Mario Kart, I recently brought the Super Nintendo to work, and there's so many people who came by and like, oh man, I remember this game, or I never got a chance to play. Can I sit down and play with you? And so it's just, it's in the games were really were simple to a certain degree, right? They had a simplicity behind it. It was just this cartridge with, you know, a ROM to save it onto. Yet there was just so much that there was so much innovation, and I think it really gave birth to what you have now with the new age consoles. But it still is a gem of a system that in the past and continues to be for those who tend to return to it.
Yeah, and Nintendo's still using the same CPU in their current system.
Ah, that's a mean swipe at Nintendo, although yeah, you're essentially right. They haven't done much advancement in the last few years. But, you know, it's interesting because, like, video games is the entree into one of the earliest pieces of technology that has moved me, which is building my own rig, building my own computer rig. You know, I grew up like you guys did playing console games, except the console games that I played were essentially the Atari 2600 and the original Nintendo, the NES. And when I moved away from there and onto more complex games, and for me, the entry for that was Zork. If you guys remember the original Infocom text
Zork.
Adventure.
Text adventures. Yeah. I didn't try my hand making one. You've been eaten by a Gru.
Exactly. Light your lantern now before you get eaten by a Gru. Look under the rug for the key. So that led to me, for me to build my own systems. It started with originally I moved from game consoles to the Atari 800. To the Atari ST. I was a big Atari fanboy for a while. And from there, once the ST had outlasted its usefulness, the next step was to build my own Windows system. So I started building my own Windows system from scratch. From there, I would basically get the case. And the great thing about building your own rig, and this is a completely lost art. Nobody does this anymore because they buy laptops or mainly because they buy laptops now. But before that,
it's the cost. The cost is so expensive. It used to be that if you wanted the tightest computer, you want to spend money for it. You'd go to a company like Alienware and you're spending $10,000.
Right.
Today, if you're building a Windows or Linux machine, you can, you know, back then, if you wanted to build like a really tight machine, you could spend $3,000 of your own money and have a comparable, if not better, machine than what an Alienware or a Dell could put together for you.
Absolutely.
But today, to do that, the cost is pretty prohibitive. And for the at-home user, the Windows machine isn't always the be-all and end-all anymore.
Right.
You know, you can get an Apple machine and have both operating systems on one device. Now it's going to be more expensive, but pretty powerful hardware allowing you to, you know, gain access to the two main operating systems pretty much out the box.
Yep. Which is what I have now with the Mac Pro. But before the Mac Pro, I had built a lot of systems, not only to play video games.
And the Mac Pro, I'm going to cut you off, but Mac Pro was Apple's response to the tower craze of the early 2000s.
Sure.
These towers were beautiful. I remember DaVinci and I would spend hours on the web finding the best Thermaltake Zaser tower or, you know, whatever else there was. And then Apple shows up with their tower and it had a great elegance. And a lot of Apple aficionados were like, oh, the industrial design's amazing. But there were towers that blew that one away in the Windows
for
world
cheaper.
For half a decade before that showed up. So.
Yeah, for a fraction of what Apple was charging, and that was where that was the world that I lived in. You know, I would find the case and then hand pick the components that I needed. And beyond playing video games, which was my entry into that world, I was also doing video editing, which is probably the most CPU intensive task you can do on any computer. And so I would get like the top of the line video card and the best sound card and fastest processor and huge hard drives. And I would be completely justified in my purchases because I could write it off as a film editor. I could write it off as a film editor. Plus the side benefit was that I had a great gaming rig as well. So yeah, that was my that was the it was one of the early pieces of technology that made me the person that I am today. How about you, Dwayne?
I loved rig building. I probably built 5 rigs between 1999 and, you know, 2005 or so, 2007 really. I love those machines, and it's a great thing. For me, the most nostalgic thing I have in terms of tech was when I was 20, which is around the year 2000, my mother got me a digital camera for Christmas. And
do you remember what it was, what the make and model was?
It was an Olympus. Yes. I don't remember the model.
Mm-hmm.
But it was an Olympus. It took 4 AA batteries. So it was pre-lithium. Mm-hmm. And those AA batteries got you about 60 shots. I had a 32 megabyte card. It wasn't XD. It was a CF card or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
32 megabytes. And after you took a picture, you had to wait while it wrote it to the disc. And after about, you know, 30 something pictures, you know, you had to find a way to get the images off of the card and onto your computer, which had a whole 60 gigabytes of space or something like that. It was a whole thing. It was obviously for me better than the film thing, because I never got those things developed, but the actual amount of pictures you're holding and the frequency with which you had to do it was pretty much in line with what a film roll was. 32 photos, take them out, kind of quote unquote develop them, that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
Email did not support, you know, 10 megabytes of images, so it wasn't like I was socially sharing these images all over the place. But yeah, I mean, these were this was like early EXIF data, so it wasn't really like completely accurate and so on and so forth. But it was a fantastic device, and I took many a photo with it. That thing was strapped to me all the time. It was my favorite possession. And I really think that, you know, I mean, within a few years, it was obsolete. Within a year, maybe it was obsolete. But I loved that device, my old school Olympus camera.
I have to say that I, one of my earliest digital cameras myself was an Olympus. I think it was the C150, if I'm not mistaken. And it, I think it ran off of not the SD cards, but like the flat, not even the CF. It was
an XD card.
It was an XD card.
Yeah. Yeah. Olympus and Fujifilm used XD cards.
Yeah.
Later on. Mm-hmm.
And, just like, to me, what an amazing sort of paradigm shift it was for me to, with the concept of being able to take as many pictures as I want and only be limited by hard drive storage space, and no longer be limited by the expense of getting your film developed. And also not knowing what your picture was going to look like until you had it developed, you know, having sort of instantaneous access to your final images within minutes of taking the picture. It was just an incredible paradigm shift for me, and that also changed my life. I props to your choice for technology there, Dwayne.
Thanks, man. Yeah, it was just like, it was so groundbreaking, you know. Mm-hmm. You took a picture, and it had it had the screen on the back. It had all that. It was a bigger device. It was about probably if you were to hold an iPhone on its side, take a photo, imagine moving your fingers 1.5 times above that thing. Yeah. And then in order to turn it on, you had to slide the front open.
Yep, yep, yep,
and
yep.
It would boot up. And it was, it was very much a digital version of what was then a modern day point and shoot. Mm-hmm. 640 by 480 was the max resolution.
And so now we move on to recent technology that has personally moved us. And we'll go once again to you, Tosin, to something recently that has really sort of revolutionized the way you use technology or think about technology.
Well, you know, one of the things that really first comes to mind for me is just really how I've in the past had to deal with entertainment and kind of the direction that that's kind of driven my life. Mm-hmm. So I would have to say in particular, what I mean here is the ability to stream and interact with content, movies, shows, things like Netflix and like Amazon Prime, Hulu, and when it comes specifically to entertainment. And because I remember as like a kid, I had the opportunity to rent movies from Blockbuster, for those who recall that ancient thing. I had the opportunity to get those, but you know, that was always a once in a time viewing. And now with entertainment at my fingertips, every single night, you know, I'm watching some sort of show. I'm watching a new age show as well as an old age show, connecting in content and also socializing it with others. And that is just extremely powerful to see the direction we go. I know some of course say, you know, this we lose a lot from missing out on some of the theatrical experiences, but I think additionally it connects us. It provides a power that you previously didn't really have a chance for. I get to see all sorts of things and learn about all sorts of different places, from like a rare sushi place in Japan, Jiro Dreams of Sushi.
Oh, great movie.
Other sorts of, you know, other things about this world that I may never have gotten a chance to experience if I still had to, you know, on occasion go and rent a physical disc. And I think that's just really powerful and pretty awesome to think that I have that luxury. And can't wait to see what happens in the future.
This is sort of what an age, right? Like, we live in an age where, like, dude, I just watched this. Go watch it. And you're like, okay. And you hit a remote control, or you pop open a laptop, or you pick out a tablet or a phone. You do some taps, type in a search, and you too are watching it. DVR is cool, but the fact is you have to have thought about recording it.
Yeah.
This stuff is just sitting there. And for anyone who's ever dealt with, I remember my buddy in college, first year back in like 1998, he had the fastest computer back in freshman year. It was like a 400 megahertz machine. And he had like 21 inch CRT, and he managed to get some copy of the Matrix, and we all sat around his computer, and he had it on his computer. It was like 600 megabytes or something. It fit on a CD or something like that. And I mean, that was a lot of work. Just however, you know, I think he got it from somebody else who had like a VCD because they visited Vietnam or some shit like that. But it was just a lot of work to get access to the content. And we all know what happened next between you know, Kazaa and all these other things that showed up, and BitTorrent and all this other nonsense.
Yeah.
Netflix allows you to get stuff without having to think about getting stuff, right? And this was even before it was streaming. Hey, I'm going to go on the website and click a couple buttons, and in a day my thing will come. Or in a couple days my thing will come. I'll watch it and I'll send it back, and it broke the mold. And then the streaming came, and it was like, wait, what? This is incredible. It's giving new life to content that would otherwise be sitting dusty on a shelf somewhere.
That long tail stuff.
It's just brilliant.
Right. I mean, that's I'd heard some conversation recently, I don't remember where, but about one of the brilliant things about Netflix is not that things like Casablanca are available on it, but the obscure titles that are the long tail titles that people would not normally have access to or even seek out without it just being there. And it's one of those things. I think it's one of those things that there's a whole generation of people that will never know the frustration of having to deal with a video rental store, you know, going down to a video rental store and trying to find the hit title that you want to watch, it being all out, and then having to settle for some, you know, piece of crap thing that's out, that's something you didn't want, and then late fees and rewinding and all of that nonsense.
I would say even more than that, going to the video store with friends or family was like the worst experience. It took about an hour to find a movie that you both wanted to see and that everybody had not seen before.
Right.
It took forever. And you had to basically, you know, there was a lot of fighting and griping. With Netflix, it's pretty clear with the amount of stuff that's right there. A lack of, you know, the inventory is ridiculous. You can't watch everything on Netflix. There's plenty of things on there that's great. And when you found something that you did like, it'll recommend the, you know, possibly related things. So, yeah, I mean, Tosin, it's good stuff. That's a great choice.
Absolutely. Dwayne, how about yourself? What's your modern thing that has completely sort of affected the way you live and breathe?
Well, there's one service in particular that stands out, but it's tied to this more recent movement since 2009 or 10, this idea of the cloud, cloud storage, you know, jumping on with, you know, piggybacking on what Tosin was talking about. His cloud storage solution is Netflix and streaming that stuff. There's also Pandora, you know, it's been legendary since 2006.
As well as Box, of course.
Spotify.
Wink, wink.
Yeah, I'm talking about services. Yeah. I'm not talking about raw storage, but I'm talking about services. I mean, Box, Dropbox, Copy, all those things are cool. But in terms of like the actual cloud services, you know, Pandora's great. It kind of broke the mold for music. And now there's like, you know, the Google Music and iTunes Radio and all that shit. But for me, one of the big things that came out recently that I use and is really meaningful to me is it's called EverPix. And once again, it's tied to pictures. I've got a Drobot at home. I've got more than 2 terabytes of images. I've been taking them since the year 2001. And, you know, I've got it all hooked up so that when my girlfriend takes a picture on her phone, it shows up, you know, on the computer and all this other stuff happens. And you know, together we take a lot of photos. We've got 2 cats and, you know, the videos and photos are out of this world. EverPix is a system that, just like Flickr and Picasa or Google Photos before it, allows you to upload your stuff. But with EverPix, it happens automatically. And there is a widget for your Windows machine, for your Mac, for your iOS and Android devices, anything you have. If you point it at a place, or, you know, when it's embedded devices, it knows where the place is, and it goes out, it seeks them out, and it actually puts the images on its system. Not only does it do that, it checks all the data in the images in order to begin tying them together. And it actually looks at the images in order to figure out which are the best pictures. So it automatically organizes everything for you. It puts it all on the cloud. Puts it all on the cloud, and it dates them and arranges them and does all this stuff completely based on the algorithms and the people working there. So it's a very no-hassle situation. It costs money. It's like $50 a year.
Mm-hmm.
But I've got 25,000 photos on there. It can figure out which photos are duplicates. You don't have like to sit there waiting for iPhoto to tell you it's a duplicate and whether or not you want to keep it or not. Because even though it's a duplicate, all of us are sitting there like, well, it might be a little different.
we go through that exercise.
But it knows the duplicates. If it finds 2 pictures that are duplicates but one is a better quality version, it's going to keep the better quality version because it knows you can always scale back down. It's figured it all out. And it does it on a regular basis. And it even goes so far as to send you snapshots of, hey, this is what you were doing a year ago. Hey, this is what you were doing 2 years ago.
Oh, interesting.
And you're able to take that and, you know, you've connected it to your Facebook, so it's pulling in that stuff. You can share it on Facebook. You can share it on anything you want. It's exhaustive when it comes to how to share it. And it's got this one feature that I like a lot called Photo Mail, which basically says, send this as a message. You know, it doesn't have to be on some social network. Send it as a message to the people that were involved. And for me, that's an easy way to keep in touch with people. Hey, this is an event we're at. Wasn't that great? The nostalgia surrounding this is really fun. When are we going to do it again? EverPix, it's a newer service. It's not exactly it doesn't have like the storied history of so many other things. But as one of those things that really has changed the way I deal with stuff. And photos have always been a headache for me. whether it's the iPhoto database getting corrupted or the amount of storage they take up or just navigating them, photos have always been a headache, and EverPix makes them not a headache. And that, to me, is huge.
Yeah, no, I definitely agree there in terms of storage. Like, I constantly find that my iPhone is no longer backing up because there's not enough space.
So, yeah, I'm getting to that point myself.
I have a 64 gigabyte iPod. I have a 64 gigabyte, I mean, iPhone and iPad. And I'm constantly fighting with pictures. And EverPix makes it so that I don't have to worry about that. In fact, if you're a paranoid photo person like me, I will extract all the photos off the phone, put them in the same place that EverPix looks, even though EverPix is already pulled up, just to wait for the report that, hey, 3,000 duplicate photos were put on EverPix, right? Mm-hmm. Like, we just uploaded 3,000 photos. They were all duplicates. I'm like, yeah, it has them already. Sometimes I guess like making computers work. you guys know what I'm talking about. Like, you're like about to get, you're about to leave the house, and you're like, well, I'll just put these clothes in the dryer, turn on the dishwasher, and have the Roomba run, just so you know that things are happening.
Right,
you're being productive, right. And you're not being productive.
Right, you're being efficient. You're maximizing your efficiency.
Exactly. So yeah, it's EverPix is pretty tight. If you haven't checked it out, they've got a 30-day trial. They have a free version too. It's just that the premium, whatever you want to call it, is just so worth it. It's just so worth it.
I'm glad you introduced me to this. I'm doing it right now. I'm uploading pictures as we speak from my photo library into the EverPix website. So I can't wait to get an experience with this. Since you're due to your glowing, your glowing.
I mean, I recommend it because I've tried everything. There are apps called PhotoSync where you can shoot the photos from your phone to the cloud or to your computer or whatever. And I'm like, I don't want to have to think about it. I just want to take them and have it tell me about them later.
Well, this brings us to my relatively current technological advance that has changed my life. And I really have to say that this has truly changed my life for the better since its invention, and that's the iPhone. And you know, there have been phones before that were smartphones, phones before it that had connected to the internet, phones before it that used apps, but it was really the confluence of the of all of these things and the way that Apple did it with a touchscreen, a capacitive touch interface, and the fact that, I mean, it is once again, it's non-trivial to say this, but it's not just a phone. In fact, I would say that ever since I got my first iPhone, using it as a telecommunication cellular device is the least thing that I use it for. It really is a mini computer, and it's having that mini computer in my pocket, that ability to access the internet, that connection to the wealth of information that is online, the connection to useful apps that I can use that are invaluable to me on a day-to-day basis. It's really changed my life. I can't imagine what I would do without a smartphone like this. Now, I mean, I can easily imagine myself shifting from the iPhone to a Samsung or another Android device, but I can't imagine not having a full-featured smartphone anymore, because it really is my connection to the outside world at this point.
I really feel as if it's not even I don't know, the word smartphone has been used for more than a decade now, and I get it. It's a phone that has computer-like features. It's smart. Like, a smart watch is a watch with computer-like features. It doesn't need a wireless connection to do what it has to do. It's just an improvement on the watch in that smart way. The thing that really takes me to the next level, takes to the next level with iOS or Android, is not just a capacitive touchscreen. Obviously, that's fantastic, right? That's a technological dream come true. That's very Star Trek. It's the apps. I think of them more as app phones than smartphones.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I know that limits them somewhat because, like, well, it's doing all these different things. But I think the distinguishing feature between the Trios and Blackberries of the past and what's available today is that you didn't have to sideload anything. The apps were, they're overwhelmingly necessary to get full feature usage out of the phone. And it is a weird space of awesome creativity. It's like a whole new internet.
Yeah.
With the apps. Some people are like, it's just a special type of website. Just getting to the same services a website gets to. But it's not, because I'm directly getting there. Yeah, I think these app phones, the smartphones, I totally see where you're coming from.
Yeah.
Now that I have my Box Aptosin, it's all good.
Well, there's going to be a new one, and it's going to be even better. But I definitely agree with you there. The iPhone, I also was one of the early adopters of the iPhone, and just using it to manage my life while in college was amazing.
Mm-hmm.
Because I just did so many things at Amherst that, you know, there was the working aspect, but there was classwork and just everything else. And it was just all at your fingertips. And, you know, I've never looked back from this sort of, you know, interconnected world. So,
right. I think it's changed the way we operate as a society. It's changed the way we think about each other as a global community as well, because we're no longer limited by geography. Our connection to the rest of the world is wherever we're at, whether it's, you know, lying on the couch or at the top of Mount Everest. You know, wherever there is a cellular connection to the rest of the world, we are now connected by our smart devices, and in particular, a smartphone.
There's actually a space, I think it's in West Virginia, where it's the federal dead zone.
Oh, really?
Yeah. There's no waves of any kind over there. I will say that I talk about this all the time, I don't like not having service.
Mm-hmm.
When I've not had service, it's typically been because I was someplace that was truly breathtaking. And at that point, at least I have the camera.
The United States National Radio Quiet Zone.
Exactly.
Centered between the National Radio Astronomy Observatory at Green Bank, West Virginia, and the Sugar Grove Research Facility at Sugar Grove, West Virginia.
You can't have waves because it'll mess up these research facilities.
Wow. I think something like this is something that Stephen King might have been referring to in one of his novels, Cell, where essentially everyone who was affected by cell phone transmission became this sort of rampant zombie, and the protagonist had to, like, their goal in the novel was to get to one of these dead zones so that they could be free from the influence of these evil, like, aggressive zombies.
Interesting. Yeah, I mean, if you think about it, you know, we've got these wearable techs like Fitbit and so on. Another thing I really like, the Fitbit situation, the quantified self stuff that we've got, that's all going to get embedded eventually.
Yeah.
You know, whether it's 20 years or 50 years, people are like, yeah, I'm getting a tattoo and I'm getting that thing embedded in me. And who knows what will happen when it comes to, you know, we can get Greg T. Davies on here and just, like, you know, the NSA hacking into who you are and changing
you to
be a bit more laid back, not unlike what, you know, the Alliance did in Serenity to make the Reavers happen. Wow, I really took that to a whole new sci-fi level.
So. I loved it. I was with you. I was with you 100%. All right. So any last thoughts about this technology that has moved us? Or any last thoughts on our existence as a podcast for 300 episodes before we sign off for tonight?
I just kind of wonder where we're going. I think we all do all the time, as a society with this tech, the abuses that we've just realized have kind of woken us up from our happy-go-lucky world of internet freedom, as well as, you know, more mundane things. As for the podcast, it's a lot of fun.
Yeah, no, I think I haven't been here for the entire ride, but 300 episodes strong, and more to come in the future. You know, it's It's interesting to see as we change and develop with each week and each year. And I think, you know, there are indeed positives, but we must balance it with, you know, societal needs and as well as, you know, see where the focus takes us. But with the innovators that we still have around, you know, I think there's a lot of promise.
Yeah, on some level, I'm sort of like, the progress you've made in this podcast is pretty astounding. I listened to the older one earlier this week. Like, if you guys, if you listeners have not heard older podcasts, go ahead and pop one on for a few minutes and just everything from production quality to content to curation has been stepped up. And I think that we only have more to, we only have more room to grow. There's only opportunity in front of us in terms of what we can do when it comes to the message of the drill down.
I have to say that being here from the very beginning, that I think this core group that we have right now, myself and you, Dwayne, and you, Tosin, I think this is the peak. This is as good as it's ever been, better than it has ever been. I think we're humming in all cylinders here, and I have to say that I personally, like, the my gratitude is with our listeners, with the people that have stuck with us from the beginning and the new people that we've accumulated along the way. I am eternally grateful for sticking with us for 300 episodes, and I only hope that you can continue to join us for 300 plus more, you know, until we run this thing into the ground. It's been quite a ride. I've really enjoyed it, and hang with us, because the best is yet to come. And having said that, Dwayne, where can we find you when you're not here on the drill down?
Well, it's late October, so soon you'll be able to find me on all sorts of mountains on Epic Mix. it's the Vail Resorts app that allows you to see what people are up to on the mountains. But normally you can always find me on Twitter, twitter.com/DwayneD, DwayneD. And you can also check me out on flavors.me/DwayneD. That's where a ton of the stuff I do is just kind of hanging out.
Tosin, how about yourself? Where can we find your work online when you're not here on the show?
You can find me at twitter.com/toast4321. And you can also find my random ramblings at ircwebcast.blogspot.com.
As for myself, you can find me at mrbabyman.com and Twitter and Facebook at mrbabyman. And just do a Google search for Mr. Babyman. You'll find all my work there. That's my online handle. And
that's a weird handle. I'm just
yes. Did I ever explain to you the origin?
I don't want to know. It's a mystery.
All right, we'll leave it as a mystery for tonight. as for our show, if you got an idea you think we should be talking about on the drill down, tweet us or email us at comments@thedrilldown.com. If you got a viewpoint on any of the stories we've talked about or any issue that pertains to technology, social media, or geek culture, you know, if you want to tell us about the tech that has influenced you, send that story to submissions@thedrilldown.com for us to publish
on
our site.
We'll definitely talk about that stuff because you sent it in.
Absolutely. And of course, let the Drill Down podcast help you reach the targeted tech-savvy market of influencers and outliers that is our amazing and dedicated audience by writing to us at sales@thedrilldown.com for details. And be sure to catch us next week at the same time and location. And that's it for this episode of The Drill Down. Thank you for joining us.
300!